morning. I figured there'd be at least one or two people here this morning. And here you are. Here you are. So this morning I'd like to talk about Manjushri Bodhisattva. And Manjushri actually is up here in behind me in one of his forms. So you can look at him while I'm talking if you want. So Manjushri Bodhisattva. Manjushri Bodhisattva is a Bodhisattva of wisdom. And Manjushri Bodhisattva usually is carrying a sword, although this one isn't. And often he has a sword in his right hand and a scroll in his left hand. And the sword is... So he's the wisdom bodhisattva, and the sword is the sword in which he punctures your point of view, my point of view. And he punctures my cherished beliefs, my most cherished beliefs. And the scroll is the Prajnaparamita scroll. So lots of people think it's a book, but actually it's a scroll. It's a Prajnaparamita scroll. So Manjushri is usually portrayed in a very beautiful way. This guy is kind of pretty, I guess. But usually he's very beautiful because he's gone beyond limited views. He's had enough punctures in his rigidity and his clinging that he's just light, he's open, and he's beautiful. Also, he's usually handsomely dressed. This Manjushri seems to be handsomely dressed. He's got kind of flowing robes, but not as handsomely as dressed as some that I've seen. And what is he handsomely dressing up? He's handsomely dressing up emptiness. He's handsomely dressing up nothingness. That is that everything is just moving and happening in one huge interdependent event. So it's nothing, and he's dressing it up. So he's doing it playfully. He's putting up makeup on emptiness, rouge on emptiness, lipstick on emptiness, so he can enjoy it. Emptiness is meant to be enjoyed, not existentially angst about. From a Manjushri's point of view, at least. Manjushri is usually riding on what? What's he usually riding on, you guys? Look, and what is that beast up there? What? A lion. Right. He's usually riding on a lion. The lion symbolizes courage. Courage. Because it's pretty courageous for us to sit in meditation day after day, month after month, year after year, and face all those beliefs, all those points of view that keep coming up, and the fear that comes up when we see the possibility that we aren't that, that we can let go of that, that we don't need it. We don't need any of it. And also he's supposed to be noble. The lion is supposed to, symbolize nobility and also courageousness. Nobility. So he's riding on the noble lion. The noble lion, the lion who knows from, if you look etymologically at nobility, G-N-O, from Gnosis, the Gnostic Gospels, before the Gnostic Gospels. And G-N-O, and GNA are very similar. GNA in Sanskrit and GNO in Old English. And GNA is knowledge. But this fellow, this bodhisattva, his wisdom is prajna, so it's before knowledge, before the split between me and you, between today and yesterday, between self and other. That's the knowing that... He's inviting us to to entertain by submitting to his sword. Submitting to his sword. So in the Prajnaparamita Sutras, are his sutras, because those are the sutras where we don't learn anything. All the other sutras, we learn stuff. Prajnaparamita Sutras, everything that's been learned gets thrown out. And in Zen, we start with the in this country, we start with the Prajnaparamita Sutras. We start with the Heart Sutras. But in Japan and China, and for hundreds of years, they would learn all the other sutras first. They would learn about the Eightfold Path. They would learn about the Four Noble Truths. They would learn about the Three Marks of Existence. They would learn about the Twelvefold Chain of Dependent Origination. And then when they were ready, they would give them the Prajnaparamita Sutras, which go through all that stuff and just burn it all, negate it all. So here, we just start every morning, we just negate it all. We don't even know what we're negating. Doesn't matter. So, Prajnaparamita Sutra, one of the long sutras says, Manjushri's is the wisdom that gives us the patience with dharmas that fail to be produced. So a dharma, that's an event. An event in our mind. The events in our mind fail to be produced. Often this happens. Always this happens. Our preconceptions don't accord with reality. Our ideas and our thoughts and our desires don't accord. So in the outside world, they fail to be produced, and that takes patience. That takes the patience of Manjushri. Just sitting. Just with his sword. Just poking at all of those preconceptions. At all of those dharmas as they come up. But not poking violently, just poking gently in stillness to see that they're just fabrications. In Japan, China, bodhisattvas are usually in the different meditation halls. There could be Avalokiteshvara, there could be Samantabhadra, there could be Jiso Bodhisattva, many different bodhisattvas. But in the Zendo, in Zen centers, only generally Manjushri. Because we do Zazen. Because our practice is to see those thoughts when they come up and just puncture them. Just let them go. Not be attached to them. So this Zendo having Manjushri would make it a typical Zendo for Zendos throughout the world, Zen centers throughout the world. So Manjushri practices the samadhi, which is not separate from wisdom. Not separate from wisdom. So in a way, just taking the meditation posture, as Dogen would say, just taking it, just watching those thoughts as they come in and go out, without judging them one after another, whether they're going at 65 miles an hour or 6 miles an hour or 600 miles an hour, is the practice of wisdom. It's the practice of wisdom just to do that. And sooner or later, we realize that. Sooner or later, they don't catch us anymore. If they don't catch us here while we're sitting, then they don't catch us in our life. Maybe a little bit, but not too much. So Manjushri is usually a young guy, and he's always a guy. And this guy looks—I can't tell. Yeah, you know, that guy looks pretty young, doesn't he? Usually a young guy, and the idea is that he hasn't been studying. Because it doesn't take years of study to do this, and he's become more youthful through his zazen. It's made him more youthful. Oh, if that were only so. Some of you are saying to yourselves, oh, if that were only so. Well, it is so. Maybe you don't realize it, but it is so. If you continue, it is so. So a young woman that I know pretty well. A couple of weeks ago, went to a Jon Kabat-Zinn retreat. It was a three-day retreat, mindfulness. It's called mindfulness-based stress reduction, but basically, he just teaches people to do zazen. Only he has it in a mindfulness structure, and there's no ritual, no ceremony at all, because it's done ecumenically. It's done in hospitals and colleges, and some of you have taken probably the 8-week or 10-week course. I actually taught it years ago. So she went to that, and that was 3 days retreat. And now they have it. This was so that they, most of the time, they just meditate. And she had, she came to have dinner at my house just because she's a friend of my kids. And she said, well, you know, she looked at me when she was talking. She usually looks at Linda, but she looked at me while she was talking, and she said, well, you know, something happened when I was sitting on something like the third day. All of a sudden, there wasn't any self or other anymore. I don't know. There wasn't any room or any Sarah, or it was just all here, but it wasn't anything. It wasn't anything. It was just everything. And she said, and I went and told them, and they said, oh, I should go back to washing my breath. I should go back to paying attention to my thoughts and my sensations. She said, did I do something wrong? And I said, well, you know, in Zen, we call that first Kensho, first Satori, first opening to the Samadhi, which is wisdom, the Manjushri Samadhi. I said, congratulations. Only I did not gassho, because this is in a this is at my home where nobody gushes. I said, congratulations. She said, oh, well, thank you. It felt good. But now I hope she doesn't get too attached to it. The problem with having early Kensho is that you kind of get attached, and then your zazen after a while gets all rough again, and you think, oh, you want that back. Oh, you want that back. So then you lose your beginner's mind and you get very old very quickly. So there's a wonderful to have that experience on our first or third day sitting. But also, be careful. Be careful. But I didn't say that to her because I'm not her teacher anyway. If I were her teacher, I'd say that to her. I'd say, forget all about it. It's great, but forget all about it. So, in sutra after sutra, Manjushri is there. But he doesn't tell people things. He's an interlocutor for Buddha. He destroys things. He mixes things up. He plays with words. He untangles words. He uses words so they are like corkscrews. Actually, Dogen takes after a Manjushri. Always playing with words. Always using words differently in a way that we can't really get, but we begin to get it, but not so much intellectually. And so he does that poking at each of our vulnerable spots, at each place that we're attached to something, and showing its limitation, showing its rigidity, and showing how alienated we get from big life by attaching to that little thing, to that little idea, that little wish that we would be different than we were, so that we can't really be here. And so Manjushri is also considered the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Shakyamuni Buddha was the seventh Buddha. There are six Buddhas before him, and he's the teacher of the seven Buddhas. He's also he of the melodious voice. Hear the melodious voice, because the melody of his voice cracks through our barriers. Just the melody, just the joy, just the tenor of his voice cracks through all of our stories. So Manjushri becomes, as all the bodhisattvas do, esteemed in Chinese culture, in Indian culture before that, and in Japanese culture. And then he becomes kind of deified, which Seems to happen in all religions. He becomes kind of deified. Then great Buddhist teachers are referred to as Manjusri. On the Buddhist prince Shotoku in Japan, considered an embodiment of Manjusri. So then cults of veneration developed over hundreds of years to worship Manjusri. And Manjusri, one of his four-line stanzas, which I put in the program, goes like this. When you attach to this life, you do not practice the way. When you attach to habituated patterns, you are not free. When you attach to your own welfare, you don't have awakening mind. When you attach to fixed positions, you don't see things as they are. So when you attach to this life, you do not practice the way. So with his sores, he's meaning to cut through our division between life and death, and just so we can let go of that division, our division between success and failure, so we can let go of that division. Katagiri Roshi used to say that if we practice sincerely with Manjushri's sword right here, the Manjushri's sword, the Zen teacher, Katagiri Roshi would say, this is Manjushri's sword, nothing else. Kill Manjushri up there and feel his sword. Feel his sword. Right? I was trained to use this, but I haven't used this in many, many years. Many, many years. He would say, if you feel Manjushri's sword, if you let those thoughts just go away and don't attach to any of them, just let them go away, that you may experience great failure. Because without your thoughts, without your desires, without your sense of accomplishment, who are you? What is this? What is this? Great failure. But he says, if your spirit is good, you will completely fail and you bounce up. And then you completely fail and you bounce up and you don't know the difference between success and failure because you just give yourself to this life, to this death. You're just here with it. So you bounce. And for a moment it's failure, but it's bounced up. Success, but bounced down. Just a little point in a wonderful way of being. So, when you attach to this life, you do not practice the way. When you attach to habituated patterns, you are not free. So all those habituated patterns, which are in six realms, the six types of habituated patterns. Habituated pattern of opposing. I'm opposing you because you're falling asleep during my talk. So I'm in a hell realm. Well, then I'm moving up to a hungry ghost realm where I'm needing you to all pay attention to my talk. I want all of you to pay attention because I don't feel secure. I want to be a good teacher. Nobody likes me. I need you. So the second type of habituated pattern. Third type of habituated pattern is survival. Survival. I want to survive here. So maybe I'll make some kind of ruckus to survive. What it could be. And the fourth kind of habituated pattern is I want to enjoy. We want to enjoy each other's presence in the human realm. And the fifth kind is fighting spirit realm. I want to be the best student. I want to be the most enlightened student. I want to have kensho after kensho after kensho. Why can't I do it? I better go over to some place where they'll at least help me do that rather than sit in this stupid Soto way where they just say, oh, just sit. What am I doing? Wasting my time. Fifth type of habituated pattern. Sixth type of habituated pattern. God realm, right? I've got it, and I want to keep it. I want to keep it. You guys maybe could get it later, but I'm going to keep it now. I'm going to keep it because I've got it. I've got it. I'm the teacher here. Maybe someday you guys can become a teacher. Who knows? Maybe so. Maybe. God realm, right? Six type of habituated patterns. But when we attach to them, we're not free. So we need Manjushri's sword. When we attach to our own welfare, we'll stay with this sword for a minute, the Kisaku. So many of you know about the Kisaku. Most of you do. I don't think it's being used too much anymore in this country. It's still used in Japan. But, you know, I practiced Zen before there was political correctness. And we didn't know. Nobody knew anything. And Suzuki didn't know it was politically incorrect to go smack around and smack people. So, plus it seems kind of dramatic to us. So, once I was in a god realm and I got smacked. I've talked about this before, but not for a couple of years. by my 4'9" teacher. Wop, 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 wop. And then the anger, growling at me. Only once. Well, he did. In this style of Zen that we practice here, you can ask for the Kisaku, but this is when this was unasked, and that was a time when I'd been in a god realm, when I'd been to a talk, which Suzuki Roshi unfortunately was at too. He was sitting in the front. I thought I was sitting in the back. I didn't think he could see me. I'd been to a talk and there was this Korean teacher in these fine robes. Talk about fine robes. Boy, he was really dressing up empty. He was dressing up empty so much he was glittering. He seemed ostentatious to me. A 60s guy. And he was dressed up. And he was telling us about karma, right? He was telling us about, he was reading from a sutra on karma and talking about how if we didn't behave ourselves, bad things would happen to us. And he was talking about rebirth and how if in this life we did something, like he gave an example and he pointed to the offering box and he said, if we stole money out of the offering box in this life, in next life we might be born with no hand. And his whole thing, his whole talk was to go through this whole list of things that would happen to us in the next life if we didn't do something in this life. Oh, I thought it was hilarious. I thought it was hilarious. And I was sitting next to this young woman next to me, who I later married, and kind of flirting with her. We were rolling our eyes. I don't know. I don't think I was laughing very much. I didn't think the guy could see me anyway. He was just focused on his fine robes and his getting his karma, which to me seemed like, God, this is Buddhist fundamentalism. Actually, it still seems like Buddhist fundamentalism to me. So the next morning, we get up, had our zazen in the morning. And Suzuki Roshi came around and just hit us hard. There were probably less people than this in the room. And only two of us had been at the talk. He hit us all, because he never discriminated when he hit us. It was way beyond discrimination when he hit us. He hit us all, and then he growled, and you don't realize the Buddhas are all around. Even someone whom you think is missing the mark is Buddha herself. And then he came around and hit us again. And that's all he said. And I saw the other people leaving the Zendo just mystified. But I knew what was going on. My girlfriend knew what was going on. So that's Manjushri, Manjushri's sword. When you attach to your own welfare, you don't have awakening. You don't have awakening. When you attach to fixed positions, you don't see things as they are. So my fixed position was kind of like, oh, this Buddhist practice is above all this. I'm above all this. This fundamentalism. But there it was, right there. And this guy was being sincere. He was sincere. So Suzuki Roshi was listening to him. But in my God realm, I was really distancing myself. Partly because this young woman next to me, whom I had just met, I didn't want her to think I'd fallen for something like that. So I needed to sort of protect my own little God realm here about the superiority of Zen. In the Prajnaparamitas, he really destroys our common sense. He destroys our common views of where we are in the world, who we should be, and our thoughts about the world. But he does that to open us up to an uncommon sense, to a prajna, to a before knowledge sense, before the dualistic, the divided up, the me-you knowledge. He's opening us up to that. He's saying that's always here, that uncommon sense. Not common, but yet always here. So Suzuki Roshi used to say, my first teacher used to say, I don't want to give you food from the refrigerator. I don't want to give you food from the refrigerator. He said there's lots of food from the refrigerator. I want you to cultivate the soil and grow your own food. A lot of religion is food from the refrigerator. Most of religion is received religion. Religion that's passed down. The books, the ritual, the robes, the bowls, the cross. Received religion. Received religion is fine, but it's not enough. And Manjusri is here to tell you to cut that received dependency away so that you can return to something more innocent. More innocent. So that you can grow the food yourself. It's harder to grow the food yourself. It's harder to grow it. Harder to get up every day and sit in meditation. Not feel like you're making much progress. Much easier just to come and listen to someone and feel okay, and do some wonderful chanting, believe in something. But our teachers are encouraging us to grow our own tomatoes, even if they're just little tiny tomatoes. And soil is not very good. If we can just grow one little tiny tomato on our own, we can help all beings. That's so much better than tomatoes that are out of the refrigerator. My religion, your religion, Muslim, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, right? Jeez. I was just been reading about the history of Muslim and Christianity. So, Muhammad's there in 635, and by 700, Muslims and Christianity are sparring with each other. And yet they're both monotheistic. They both have many of the same ideas, many of the same beliefs. They come from the same part of the world. But by 700, the Muslims are in Spain. They're going to educate the barbarians in Spain, the Christian barbarians, about the true way. And they stay in Spain for, 400 years? And they allow the Christians to be there, but the Christians have to wear badges saying they're Christians because they're a lower form of life. This is religion out of the refrigerator, right? My religion, your religion. My peas are better than your peas. They're made by this company or this firm. And then the Christians get their revenge on the Muslims in Spain after 300 or 400 years. And what are we doing now? What are we doing in the 21st century? And then we have Judaism coming in there too. But I'm not going to get into all that. Buddhism does that a little. And when Buddhism does that, they're forgetting Manjushri's sword. They're forgetting Manjushri's sword. So we forget Manjushri's sword. It's too bad. But then we have someone to remind us, even if it's our own conscience. If we have a well-developed conscience, I don't mean super-ego conscience based on what you were taught, but conscience based on your feeling of that you want to cultivate this ground to help all beings, that you don't want to say your tomatoes are someone's better than someone else's, that you just want to give them a bite of your tomato and take a bite of theirs and not say whose are best. Completely forget about who's the best tomato. Just enjoy cultivating it. And sharing it. Feeding each other. So, Manjushri then, as in all religion, Manjushri turns into a deity, right? Manjushri turns into a hot shot, right? I mean, after all, everybody wants to be Manjushri. Prince Shotoku is Manjushri. We've got Manjushri statues in every zendo. So when this happens, now it's time for Manjushri, for the counter Manjushri to puncture Manjushri. So here's a story in the Gateless Gate where Manjushri gets punctured. Once Manjushri went to a place where many Buddhas had assembled with the world-honored one. When he arrived, all the Buddhas had returned to their original dwelling place. Only a young woman remained, seated in Samadhi near the Buddha's seat. Manjushri addressed the Buddha and said, "How can that young woman get near the Buddha's seat when I cannot?" What's happened to Manjushri? What's happened to the great sword-cutting Manjushri? Well, he's become enamored of his own wisdom, hasn't he? And now he's jealous. Now he's what? Now he's in a fighting spirit realm. He's caught in a fighting spirit realm himself. There he is. So he has to be knocked off the altar, completely demolished, which happens in this story. The Buddha replied to Manjushri, "Awaken this young woman from her samadhi and ask her yourself." So it's a young woman. And young women in China can never get close to Buddha. You know why, right? Because young women are second class, third class, fourth class citizens. They're barely humans, young women. So this young woman is actually not only close to Buddha, but she's in samadhi. So no wonder Manjushri is pissed off, right? Because he's a bodhisattva of wisdom. But you see, he's deteriorated to the fighting spirit, Manjushri, because so many people told him he was great. But the young woman, the innocent young woman, she's replaced him. She's there, just in her gentle, peaceful samadhi. Buddha replied to Manjushri, "Well, awaken this young woman and ask her for yourself." Buddha's not taking any sides here. Not going to get involved in this. Manjushri walked around the woman three times. He snapped his fingers once. He took her to the Brahma heaven. That's a Hindu heaven where Hindu god hangs out, Brahma. And exerted all his supernatural powers, but he couldn't bring her out. He couldn't bring her out. So then Buddha says, even 100,000 Manjushris can't awaken her. Down below, past 1,200 million lands, as innumerable as sands of the Ganges, lives the Bodhisattva of delusive wisdom, or Momyo. So a bodhisattva of delusive wisdom. The bodhisattva of delusive wisdom is in the first stage of the 52 stages toward enlightened life, toward wise life. In the bowels of the earth, the bottom of the compost heap. Down below, past 1,200 million lands, as innumerable sands of the Ganges, lives the bodhisattva of delusive wisdom. He will be able to bring her out of samadhi. And everybody in the audience goes, oh! They don't even want to see this smelly bodhisattva who's just, who's filthy in all ways. But instantly the bodhisattva of delusive wisdom emerges from the earth and makes bows before the Buddha, who gives him his imperial order. Imperial order? I don't know. Well, often Buddha is treated like a king in these stories. Delusive wisdom stepped before the young woman, snapped his fingers once, and at this she came out of samadhi. So that's the story in the Gateless Gate. And then there's a commentary on it. There's a commentary. So let's do the commentary. We'll finish with the commentary. By Woman. Old Shakyamuni put on a disorderly comedy this time. No better than a child. Manjushri is the teacher of the seven Buddhas. Why couldn't he bring the young woman out of samadhi? Delusive wisdom is a bodhisattva at the very beginning level. How could he bring her out? If you can see into this intimately, then in the flurry of karma and discrimination, you are a dragon of great samadhi, says Woman. Then Woman's verse ends it. One can bring her out, the other cannot. Both of them are free. Both of them are free. So if you completely do it, even if you completely fail, you're completely succeeding. You're beyond it because you're giving yourself to it. You're free in your failure. And you're free in your success because you don't get caught by it. You just do it. So you're bouncing. You're bouncing all around with life. Life is always like this, moving. So get out of the refrigerator. Don't live in the refrigerator, please. Well, I know it seems like a refrigerator out there, but even out there, it's not frozen. Really, if you look at it, even if it's frozen, it's all alive. Just stop and look at one of those little sparkling things of snow and see it. Everything there. Always. One can bring her out, the other cannot. Both of them are free. A god mask, a devil mask. So, Manjushri sometimes is a god, sometimes he's a devil. Sometimes he succeeds, sometimes he fails. It's a great comedy of life. The great tragedy, I know, but also comedy. A god mask, a devil mask. The failure is an elegant performance. Just what Woman has to say. The failure is an elegant performance. So I think I'll finish with one more story about Manjushri. So Manjushri, while he is loved throughout Buddhist history, sometimes he is poked fun at, and especially in Zen. Even though he may be on a pedestal one time, another time the teacher is taken and put him down on top of the toilet or even below the toilet because as a teaching. So here's a story about a cook in the kitchen, a tenzo in the kitchen during a seven-day retreat. The head cook, the tenzo. So the head cook is devoting himself to his practice of preparing the food, and sitting whenever he can, and he's preparing his food for a large sesshin for 60 people. We're going to have 48 people when we have Reb Embers come. So the tenzo is really going to have to be really working, forgetting about success and failure, just giving himself to one moment at a time with a meal. So this tenzo is in the kitchen really working his samadhi of cooking. and he's so into it, his consciousness is very still, and then he sees in front of him, right on the wall above the stove, he sees what? Manjushri appears. Manjushri appears. And is he in awe? No, he's not in awe. He grabs his spatula. He grabs his spatula and he whacks Manjushri's image. And he says, if Shakyamuni came, I would also drive him away. And he goes back to cooking his string beans. So that's the last story about Manjushri I want to tell. That's all I need to say, I think. I probably didn't need to say this much. Maybe I didn't need to say anything. But you came all the way out here in the cold, so I had to say something. Comments, questions? Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Did you hear what she said? Could you? Okay. She said, I said in the United States we start with the Heart Sutra, but in other countries they start with other sutras. What's that about? Well, actually, I think as our Buddhism evolves in this country, we won't be starting with the Heart Sutra. I would say that in 50 years or 100 years, we probably won't be starting with the Heart Sutra. We start with the Heart Sutra because when Suzuki Roshi came here, I mean, he was already, he's 50 years old, I can't remember, 52, 55 years old, and he felt that there were a lot of people who were hungry for something beyond form, and that they were ready to really do zazen and puncture their beliefs about the world. He didn't need to teach them a whole new culture of beliefs. Historical Buddhism gives you a culture of beliefs. If you've been studying with it, some of you have been studying with it. We started in early Buddhism, then we go through Indian Buddhism, Mahayana, China, Chinese Buddhism, different facets of Chinese Buddhism. Now we're into Japanese Buddhism. There's a culture of beliefs. All of those beliefs are about dismantling beliefs, but still there's a certain culture. And he thought, I'm sure he thought, God, I'm 55, you know. These people already have a culture that they need to be free from. Why do I have to teach them a second culture and then teach them to be free from that? So the Heart Sutra is about being free. What he didn't teach us was lots of the Buddhist subtleties about mindfulness, about different types of mindfulness meditation, about different facets of Buddhist psychology and how they can be helpful to you, how it can be helpful to you to learn those things. Because he wanted us to get the raw stuff, but as Buddhism develops in this country, we're now studying the texts, and we're doing the sitting too, and we're not trying to do it all in 5 years. He came in 1959, and he was dead in 1972, and Katagiri Roshi was kind of like that too. You know, he wasn't here that long. But you know how the end of his life, Katagiri Roshi, I wasn't here then, but he really started emphasizing more some of the beautiful cultural manifestations that came from Dogen. It's a very good question. Anything else? Okay, thank you.